Welcome, everyone, to WFHR's Director's Cut for this Sunday, session number 55. Your host and program director here, James J. I'm joined by my partner in art, our head of production, Seth Habhager. Seth, the mics are on. Let's roll.
Let us do so. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining us this evening. We're going to be doing another movie show. We've got a couple of films that we recently viewed, and we're going to go way back, everyone. Mm-hmm. We're looking at silent movies.
Yes.
And I did want to address one thing real quick, James, before we got started with your film, Gold Rush, classic by Charlie Chaplin. And I'm going to be doing The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, regarded by most people as the very first horror film. Two very fascinating things, fascinating films. And I think people will be enjoying this. But I do want to caution people who've not seen many silent films from back in that era. We're talking 1920s. I think they're both from that era, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. It's a very different form of film, mm-hmm. a different form of acting, a different way of filming it, where the cameras were set up and everything like that. So it may take you a little bit when you're going to watch your first silent movie to get into it, because it's like, wow, this is really different from what I'm used to for movies. But that's okay. You'll get used to it. Just got to get into it, get on the movie's wavelength, like we like to say here. And we do want people to watch these movies because they're very important to what comes after, of course. But they're also works of art in their own right.
Well said. And a lot of fun, too. If you can let yourself get into it, you can just enjoy so much of the different storytelling that mm-hmm. it takes place. And I want to touch on that a little bit with the Gold Rush. And I'm sure that you may have some notes as well on
sure.
that
mm-hmm.
With your film.
Yep.
One of the things that I want to get to first with this movie is talking about the dissection of the movie.
Okay.
With the way that this film was made in particular. In 1925's The Gold Rush, Charlie Chaplin transformed his most famous character, the Little Tramp, into a lone prospector, wandering through the Klondike in search of gold. Most people know what the Gold Rush was mm-hmm. and what it what took place. So you kind of automatically go into it with a little bit of understanding of that in the back of your head. But I think that even with the opening scene, and you've got the opening scene, seeing people traveling, literally traveling mm-hmm. through the mountains and everything. You've got about 300 some extras a part of this scene
wow.
that Chaplin hired, most of them prospectors themselves. So the close-ups, the looks that you're getting,
wow.
you're actually seeing prospectors. You're actually seeing people doing this. You could do a movie right now about the Gold Rush and maybe have the best graphics in the world, one of the greatest writing teams behind it, greatest directors, all these different things. But it would be in 2024.
Mm-hmm.
This was done and filmed literally during, you know, and still when there was a tail end right. of a gold rush going on.
The Klondike gold rush was in the late 1890s, like 1898, and of course beyond, it lasted longer than that. So we're talking about like just 20 years at the most removed from when it had happened, which is really remarkable.
And there's really two versions of this film. The film, which Chaplin re-released with sound in 1942, features some of the most famous and oft-parodied images in film history.
Right.
Certainly the eating the shoe, the bread roll dance, things like
yep.
this. After its 1925 premiere, though, was when Chaplin said that this was the movie for him. And we've got some random facts about this movie and everything that I'll get into where I'll talk more about that. But the movie itself I want to focus on first. I don't know why I did this to myself, but the two films we've done so far, the first one, Arsenic and Old Lace, was my Nana and I's movie.
Mm-hmm.
I watched that movie at least 11,000 times with her.
At least.
And then there was this one, The Gold Rush, which I have watched with my papa probably about 15,000 times. Him and I, huge Chaplin lovers. So
right.
the movie starts up, and I found it on HBO Max. A big shout out to them for having these movies on there.
Yeah, exactly.
I thought I was going to have to go through a bunch of different things to be able, I found it right away.
Awesome. That's great.
And I've never seen it more beautiful. I've never seen
wow.
it look so good.
I suppose it's been remastered since the last time you've seen it. Yeah.
And the opening credits popped up and I immediately started to tear up. And I had to pause the movie. Mm-hmm. I had to compose myself. It took me a good 10 minutes to do so. I did not expect it to hit me that much. And that is one of the things that film can do. And oh, I think is noteworthy, just as a side note.
Yep.
The beauty of a good film and what the memories they can create.
Absolutely.
And a shout out to my papa, because I wouldn't have ever known about Charlie Chaplin or these movies without him and everything. So I really do appreciate that. Reading into watching. This is what silent films were working to do. Mm-hmm. How do we get people to care about the visual along with after getting them into radio? Mm-hmm. And having that, or how do we bring vaudeville to radio? How do we combine these worlds? We've got this new thing, this new picture thing that we can do. And so silent film was the bridge of this, between these, where you had, for those who don't know, you would have a scene often pop up with a black background and words on it to tell you a couple of quick sentences, either what the character said or to set up the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And this went into the visual of it.
Yes.
Now, editors had a very difficult time here, and storytellers had almost even a more difficult time. One of the things helps is when you do it all. And that is what Charlie Chaplin did.
Exactly. Literally did it all.
You will see him as the writer-director of these films. Not only that, but oftentimes the editor of the film, the cinematographer oftentimes being behind the camera and making sure everything's set up. It helps a little bit when you've got the same mind behind it all.
That's right.
Also can be a little crazy about that.
Mm-hmm.
But telling a story with your eyes, your emotions, this is what was asked of actors back then.
Right.
And while we talk a lot about the difference of film acting and theater acting, the difference of vaudeville acting and, well, we've never done this before.
Right. Brand new territory.
So the work you're seeing in the Gold Rush and so many of these movies, it's trailblazing. It's nothing short of trailblazing. There are techniques and things that they did in these movies that we're still doing today.
Yep.
And we're teaching young actors today.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things when you're watching these movies, especially this one in particular, I really encourage you to focus on the facial expressions. You've still got a lot of old theater acting going on with this.
You do.
While also trying to adapt to modern times, no pun intended.
Yep.
So I'm talking
that was great, yeah.
It's kind of cool to see.
Well, and doing it without sound, which again, I mean, even with theater actors, they at least got to use sound. They got to use their voices. You can't do that with silent films, and that's a whole other ball game as well.
I think one of the other things that stands out with this is the makeup. The makeup teams, it wasn't just actors that had to learn to adapt to screen.
Mm-hmm.
One of the bigger industries that really had to adapt was makeup. Oftentimes in theater, you use a lot more makeup. In movies, you don't need as much.
No.
And that's kind of modernized a little bit where both fields kind of do the same thing now. But it's still something that was really noteworthy back then. I encourage people to check out the makeup. The way people told stories with their eyes.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much acting with people's eyes in these movies. This one in particular, there are some techniques and some things that they do in this movie in particular. There's a fade edit that goes on where the tramp is turned into a chicken, kind of. And it's a guy in a chicken costume.
Right.
And with that fade, you would think they did it today. Like, it's the same techniques we're using that they were just starting to modernize and create.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really cool job. So some of the editing and some of the things that go on in this movie were fascinating to me that they're still that they started the trend almost of these things. It's another thing that you see and you're like, oh, well, I've seen that before, but you didn't see it the first time it was done. Like, that's how what happens in a lot of these silent films.
Exactly.
I'll have a couple notes on that with your film, Seth. The makeup was amazing. Charlie Chaplin may have been the master of camera angles and deception. Like, I look back and I see things he was doing, and I'm like, where have I seen that before? Oh, Hitchcock. Oh, Hitchcock did that.
Wow.
Oh, Spielberg did this. And I sure enough, I paused the movie so I could go back and look and see enough. And, oh, yeah, Hitchcock talking about being influenced by Chaplin. Spielberg talking about being influenced by Chaplin. Like, it's really cool to see, and something I never thought about with Charlie Chaplin. But he would put the camera in these angles, in these spots that people would never think of. And and it gave you a different perspective and a different empathy as a viewer to these characters. It was so important for him that you cared about these individuals, that you you felt like you knew them. And it may have never done it better than in this movie. The movie also speaks to what we'll do to survive and who we are willing to do it with. It creates a lot of that. It gives you a bit of an understanding of what it was like in that time to be in those moments. The this insanity of trying to do that in today's day and age. If Seth and I wanted to go and do this and go prospecting, it would still be crazy. But we have a lot of benefits, a lot of things nowadays that would really benefit us.
Would make it easier. Yeah, absolutely.
The lives, the amount of people we lost, the amount of things that happened and everything during that time. It is the true Wild West in the truest extent. Even if you don't go back and see this movie, I cannot encourage you enough to go back and look at two in particular scenes. The boot scene, and if you just throw that in your search bar, you'll find it.
Yes, it'll be
I have a couple of fun random facts about that in a moment, but that scene in particular is so well done, acting with their eyes.
Mm-hmm.
It's all done with their eyes, and you know everything that they're thinking and saying with their eyes.
Yep.
And the balancing cabin scene. You talk about things that were ahead of their time. Maybe nothing else more than that part, that particular scene in this movie. They're using a lot of technology that they would end up using in a lot of B horror movies later on,
right,
where they're kind of almost imposing, like this seems bigger than it actually is.
Right, right.
And
forced perspective stuff, yeah.
And in that scene, you will also see Charlie Chaplin flying around all over the place. Mm-hmm. You do in two different particular scenes. If you look really closely, you could actually see on one of his legs a cord that he was using to pull some of the house because they didn't have enough people and they didn't have enough all this stuff to be able to do it.
That's amazing.
There's also something in here. I always thought that I was a foolish romantic because of my family. I come from a family of romantics, and that might be a little bit of it. But it's also this dang movie, because in this movie, Charlie's character he doesn't have a belt. He's a tramp. He doesn't have a belt, so he's dancing with this woman he falls in love with, and he needs a belt. So he grabs this belt that happens to be attached to a dog, and so the dog is dragging him around all over the place. He's getting hit by snowballs. Pelted. There's no, stunt actor that walks in or something.
No.
And it looks like Chaplin told him, hey, just chuck it. all these different things that he has happened in front of this woman. He gets set on fire at one point and everything. And he still ends up with the girl. He still ends up with her. I mean, I'm a foolish romantic, but I don't know if I, you know.
That's par for the course for Chaplin, of course. The ridiculousness of the situations that he ends up in. Yeah.
In all seriousness, it does speak to karma a lot, this movie, and a lot of, putting good into the world and what good can come from it. It's a short movie, especially by today's standards, and a fun watch, I think. I think especially, and worth the watch. Noted from this movie, just some random facts. Long before Chaplin directed the Great Dictator, he was considered enemy number one of the Nazis, who believed him to be Jewish, even though he wasn't. His half-brother Sidney was, but he was not. And the Chaplin, his life and art biographer David Robinson explained some of this, that the Gold Rush was banned for early years from the Third Reich, like all Chaplin movies. Mm-hmm. So Charlie did something that I put up there with Jesse Owens and one of the greatest ever, just like stiff arms to the Third Reich and everything.
Right.
And I would have had, I've read so much, read so many biographies on him. I don't pretend to know him, but I feel very confident saying that was one of the biggest feathers in the cap for Chaplin. Chaplin couldn't stand what they were doing, what
absolutely
the Nazis were doing, had a huge distaste for Hitler, and the idea that he was disliked by them that much, I guarantee you he had a lot of pride in that.
Right, right. And, it's funny, just a little sideways thing here. By the way, when we get to the cabin of Dr. Caligari, we will be talking about Nazis again. Sorry, we got to do it at that time, that era, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I do want to say that the fact that he had such a physical resemblance to Adolf Hitler, that worked beautifully in The Dictator, the way he did. The fact that he understood that and went with the way he did it. That he was a genius.
The majority of actors just would have shaved their mustache. The majority of actors would have done every single thing they could.
He put one on.
He leaned in. Yes, you're so right about that. The famous boot scene I mentioned there. That boot that they are eating, take no worries, it's not real leather, is made of licorice.
Yes.
And they actually had, I misquoted this earlier to you, Seth, they had about 20 pairs that they made.
That's still a lot. Big boots of licorice. That's a lot.
Charlie was a constant perfectionist, and Big Jim McKay, the actor that plays him, also had to eat a boot. And so they actually had a couple that they went through, but the scene took 3 full days and 63 takes to capture in total.
What?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Incredible.
That's absolutely insane.
Chaplin hired 600 extras for that opening shot, did you see? And again, most of them prospectors themselves and everything. The Man. Of those extras, though, the highest paid of them was a dog. There was a dog, an extra on the set. Now, the extras were paid a base rate of $7.50 a day.
Actually, not bad for the 1920s. I got to say, that's not bad.
Yeah. Now, you would never see that, I don't know, as a modern price for something like paying employees, but I digress. A whopping $35 a day, though, went to the dog.
Oh, my gosh.
And its handler, of course.
Of course, but, yes. I wonder what he did with all that money.
No. Right. And when it comes to the premiere in Germany, at the German premiere, audiences called for an encore.
For a movie.
For a movie.
For a movie.
That's incredible.
That is, wow. Blow my mind. Blow my mind.
I don't know. I don't know how you top that.
No.
And of course, Chaplin re-released this in 1952. Now, oftentimes with the re-release, he would actors, not just him, but other actors mm-hmm. for movies would actually show up to the premieres, which is where that all stems from, and either act things out or talk to the audience, like do Q&As and mm-hmm. stuff like that. Was nothing. That was common back then. Chaplin was a big believer in this, to the point where he would almost show up to like almost every city's premiere. Try to beat all of these.
Which is really cool.
And Charlie Chaplin later performed the famous bread roll dance for Pablo Picasso.
Of all people.
On a visit to France in the 50s, Chaplin visited Picasso in his art studio. The two didn't share a common language, so instead chatting, Picasso gave Chaplin a tour of his latest works in progress, mm-hmm. while Chaplin, in return, performed his famous scene for him. How cool is that? This is fascinating. Just a couple more real quick. I want to get in here.
Keep them coming.
Originally, a stagehand wore the chicken suit in Jim's Hallucination, but the stagehand could not get down Chaplin's mannerisms. So Chaplin ended up getting in the suit and doing that scene, too.
Because he had to, yes.
The perfectionist that he was.
The perfectionist, yep.
The dancing role sequence was so popular with audiences that in some cases, such as the film's Berlin premiere and some other ones, mm-hmm. Projectionists stopped the film and replayed the scene.
Can you imagine that? In today's... In a movie theater. We're used to it, you know, on TV, but in a movie theater, they literally stop the movie, rewind it so people can watch it again. I love it. That is so cool.
Between that and the standing ovation. Like, I've never heard anything like that before.
Encore.
With a movie.
How do you do an encore with
a
movie?
I've literally never heard that before about a movie before. Mm. An actual American black bear was used for the scenes with the Lone Prospector where there was a bear.
That's kind of frightening. I'm sure it was a trained bear, but still.
Since I was a little kid, I thought that was a fake bear. They've a real bear on there with them.
They didn't have the special effects like we do. You had your special effect. Wow, here's a real bear. Yeah.
Had something horrible happened, we couldn't have even blamed Charlie because it was his fault. He felt that every costume was too fake looking and audiences wouldn't believe it. I don't think it gets said enough about Charlie Chaplin. There's a lot of things that you can say about him mm-hmm. off the field that I don't like, I don't feel good about, and everything.
He's like human. He was very human, yes.
The man, the actor, while a perfectionist, while could be hard to work with and work for sometimes, mm-hmm. never did anything he didn't expect from himself. Yep. And I don't know if there are many people that respected their audience more than Charlie Chaplin. He wanted you to be entertained. He wanted you to love these movies, and he wanted to do them for you. And it's part of the reason why I think they're so timeless.
Yep.
I was wondering if the Gold Rush would hold up or not. Boy, did it. Did it. I'm so thankful we're doing this episode that I went back. I wouldn't have mm-hmm. went back and watched it otherwise, probably.
Right.
I've been meaning to since for about a year I have, since my papa passed, I've been mm-hmm. meaning to, and I haven't. I wrap up on this. Sir Charlie Chaplin stated that this was the film by which he most wanted to be remembered. And he said that back in 1920 when it was first released.
Oh, wow.
And he repeated it again back in 1944 when it was re-released. Mm-hmm.
And I think he got his wish.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of there's so many brilliant films that Charlie Chaplin did in his lifetime. I was telling James earlier, my favorite personal favorite is Modern Times, which was later. It was 1936, mm-hmm. which he made a silent movie when the talkies were there to stay. Yeah. I mean, they were the movie at that time, were the talkies, and he stuck to his guns. Mm-hmm. Still a brilliant movie, you know. He sings at the end. You get to hear him finally use his voice. By the way, beautiful singing voice, a speaking voice with that English accent. I mean, I'm telling you, he could do it all. He could do it all. One thing that I wanted to point out, and I just thought about it when you were talking, James, you know, people might ask, well, why was he so interested in doing, you know, the realism. Why did he need the realism in those films? They're comedies, you know, why do it? That's why. If you have the realism there, that makes the outrageousness of the comedy bits that much better. Mm-hmm. You like you say, you know, he's eating a boot. You know, he's doing it like it's like any old thing. Yeah, you know, just like, oh, this is my meal. I'm eating the shoe leather kind of thing. The rocking cabin, you know, just outrageously a ridiculous scene. But it plays so well because everything else is normal. That's why it works. That's why it's funny.
It set a standard for comedy too. It set a standard for filmmaking in a lot of ways with the that. And while we went away from it at times and everything, here we are again, where old is new and new is old, and we're coming back to that's the kind of comedy people want. Yep. That's the kind of entertainment.
It doesn't age, like you
want.
Said. It does not age. It's timeless. You can always enjoy Charlie Chaplin being the little tramp.
Yeah. It's a classic film. Encourage you to check it out, everybody. Mm-hmm. The Gold Rush, starring the great Sir Charlie Chaplin.
All right. Well, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to get to my movie, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, when we get back to Director's Cut.
Welcome back, everybody, to WFHR's Director's Cut. Got your host, James, here, along with my co-host, Seth Habhager.
Yes, I'm here, and I'm ready to go.
And we're ready to talk about your film, Seth. And thank you for picking one of the quintessential films to have this conversation. We'd be talking about this film anyway, no matter almost what film movie you'd chosen. But why not start right here at the what most will consider the beginning of it all when it comes to horror.
In a lot of ways. In a lot, more than just horror, too, surprisingly enough. It's from 1920. It's called The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. It was a German film, of course. Back then, silent films were international films because you could just change the title cards to whatever language you wanted. And that meant that this was shown all over the world. It was directed by a man named Robert Wine, written by Carl Mayer and Hans Janowitz. Sorry, look at that. Try that again. Hans Janowitz. And it was starred Werner Krauss, Conrad Veidt. More on him later. He had a very interesting life. In fact, they both did. So we'll get into both of those when we get into the show. So first, I want to kind of set the scene to where I saw the movie. I was just recently, a couple weekends ago, I went down to Madison to the Overture Center. They have, of course, the Capitol Theater there. And there's a thing that they do. It's called Duck Soup Cinema. Like about three times a year, they show a silent film, have a live organ there. They do kind of a little act beforehand, just like you would back in the day. When you went to the movies, you didn't just go to see a movie. You got to see a vaudeville act, maybe a magician. They'd have all kinds of stuff going on before you actually saw the movie. So they kind of they try to recreate that a little bit. One of the really cool things about it, if you ever get a chance to do it, I would recommend it. Go see a silent movie with a live organ playing the music. That is how it was done back in the day. And I got to give all the credit to the world for these organists. They are amazing playing live with the film, creating this, you know, help with the atmosphere and everything. It was truly a fabulous experience. And I would recommend people, if you get a chance to do it, do it, because live organ on a silent movie, it is absolutely great. To quickly go over the plot, it is a little bit convoluted, to say the least. There's a framing story. A young man is telling, sitting on a park bench, and he's telling this other man of the horrible things that have gone on. And then we do a flashback, and we find out that it takes place in a German town. There's carnival going on, and Dr. Caligari, who is a very sinister-looking character, comes into town. He wants to set up an act for the festival that's going on. He says he has a somnambulist, so, which is basically just a person who sleepwalks. That's what that means. So he's got this, and because he's been sleeping, he claims this man has been sleeping for 24 years, and he knows all the secrets, and he can tell your future because of this. So he puts up his thing. The young man and his friend go to see it. Cesar, that's the name of the somnambulist, wakes up, and he said, is there any person in the crowd who has a question? So the young man's friend goes up. He's like, when will I die? And he says, you have not long to live. You will die before dawn. And of course, the guy freaks out, everything. And you see later, he does get killed. He gets murdered by someone with a knife. The friend, devastated. His friend has been killed. He wants to investigate and find out what it is. As it goes along, we find out that Dr. Caligari is using Cesar as his weapon to murder people. We see
through hypnosis.
Through yes, he has hypnotized him, kind of thing, and he wakes him up and he orders him to do things. This culminates in Cesar being sent to kill the woman, the main character's fiance, and he fails. He ends up abducting her, gets chased by a crowd, leaves her by, and then Cesar ends up dying in a field. So that's kind of the first part of the movie. It takes a twist. We find out that Dr. Caligari, we see him sneak into an insane asylum, and it's like, oh, wow. Oh, he's crazy. He's a crazy man. So the young man goes, he sees him go in there, and he goes in, and he says, I got to find this one. He looks like this. They go up, and he says, well, talk to the director. They go up to talk to the director, and that's Dr. Caligari is the director of the insane asylum. And I could have said spoilers. This movie's 100 years old.
Yeah,
I mean, come
yeah,
on.
Right.
We're not going to do spoilers with that. So I'm not worried about spoilers on this one. So we find out that Caligari has been studying, and that's not his real name. He studies the hypnotism by the actual Dr. Caligari. He feels he is insane, feels like he has to become Caligari, and it ends up he gets put in a straitjacket, the director does, because he is obviously insane after they find out that he's behind all of the killings. We go back to the frame story, and another twist, once again, spoilers, I guess. The other twist is we find out the young man is in an insane asylum, and the director is Dr. Caligari. He is sane at this point, and they find out that this all was in his head. This was all crazy and everything like that. So basically, that is the plot. The two writers of the screenplay were both pacifists. Now you have to remember, this was 1920, very shortly after World War I had ended. Germany at the time was in a lot of turmoil in 1919 and 1920. Basically, throughout the war, the government had fed everyone day after day propaganda. Everything's going good. The war, we're winning the war. We're doing this on the home front. All of a sudden, the armistice happens and they realize we lost. And this was like, it's hard to explain what this did to the German people. Because they thought this whole time that they were on the winning side. They were the ones going. And it caused a lot of reflection. The two writers here, they were both pacifists. One served in the army. The other one feigned madness to get out of the army. He ended up in an insane asylum, which is where he got a lot of the ideas for this movie. You really have to understand German cinema in the 20s has a lot to do with trying to reconcile what happened in World War I.
And nobody, not talking about the lives that were lost, certainly mm-hmm. of World War I, as far as a country goes, Germany kind of like took the, like got thrown under the bus.
In a lot of ways, it's true, yes.
Like they were the only ones that did anything wrong
right.
or anything.
They had to take the war guilt, yep.
They, not only that, but the sanctions and the different mm-hmm. things that they were to put on Germany in that place. And it may sound weird to hear a Jew talking defending Germany, but it was an overkill. And it really mm-hmm. set them back. And you can make an argument that World War II, Germany may not have been susceptible to a madman had they not been as punished as they were after World War I.
Right.
And it led to so much of not just this movie, but so much of the art mm-hmm. being in this kind of like confused and macabre state
yeah.
that they were almost forced into, that they were already in, but they, as you said, they were in it, but they had hope. They had feeling. They were mm-hmm. trusted their God. They didn't have the internet to pull up, or they didn't have a bunch of journalists out there doing
saying,
big
no, no,
reporting.
No, it's not really. It's actually going really bad for you guys, right?
All they had was to be able to take the word of mouth, which is part of where a lot of critics and a lot of people think of the doctor as basically being Germany, being the metaphor
right.
of
that
Germany.
That authority figure yeah. that's lying to you, that's not telling you the truth. And then that led to a lot of anti-authoritarianism, too, which ironically led to, like you said, there's the connection between that and the Nazis and all that sort of thing. Getting to the cast and crew really quick, the Robert Wine, the director, he had a lot to do with, especially with this film, because it was such a big hit, about how films looked, especially in Germany, but all worldwide as well. We'll get into the sets and stuff in just a minute about why this movie was so interesting to look at. Mm-hmm. But it was with that film and with this film and the film he did after that, which was an adaptation of Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, two very influential films. He didn't do a lot after that. He was Jewish, which meant he had to flee Germany when the Nazis took power. He did end up overseas for that. Now, the two stars of the film, Werner Krauss and Conrad Veidt, had two very different careers. very after this, especially. Mm-hmm. I'll start with Werner Krause. He's the one that plays Dr. Caligari and the director of the insane asylum. Again, you have to get used to his performance. It's very over the top. But, of course, he's playing an insane guy for most of it.
Well, that was the acting back then.
And that was the acting, like we spoken of earlier. So he was a well-respected actor in German films through the 1920s, through the silent era. Unfortunately, when the Nazis took over, he was very much with them. He was an open anti-Semite. And he became very integral to the film society of Germany, the National Film Society or whatever they called it.
Yeah.
But it was run by the state, basically. So he made, interestingly enough, he ended up playing Jews in a lot of the propaganda films that the Nazis made. These really, I mean, horrifically stereotypical, just really nasty stuff that they did for propaganda purposes. After the war, he did it. It did come back to bite him. You were talking about karma again. After the war, he couldn't get work because of his collaboration with the Nazis and that sort of thing. He ended up moving to Austria, where he was quietly lived out the rest of his life in obscurity, basically, kind of thing. Conrad Veidt, on the other hand, he had a very interesting career after this. He was in some very, very important silent films in Germany throughout the 1920s. Probably his best other performance that he gives was in a film called The Man Who Laughs, which is also kind of a horror movie as well. He's amazing in this film. It's not, actually, his role is pretty small. He doesn't have a big part, but there's a couple of scenes, and I'll get to that too later, that is just remarkable. He was not Jewish, but he married a Jewish woman. In 1933, when the Nazis took over to save her, they immigrated to England. He became a part of the English Film Society. Mm-hmm. Ironically enough, ended up playing a lot of Nazis because he was German, and he played it really well. Most people today will know him as Major Strasser in Casablanca.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, was the last film that came out before he died. He died in 1943 from a heart attack. Yes.
Oh, wow.
There was a movie or two that came out after he passed, but that was the last one that came out while he was still alive. So you did get to see his remarkable performance as, again, a nasty Nazi
that
he played in that movie. But he did it,
God,
he did it really well.
He's one of the better villains in movie history.
Absolutely.
Movie.
It was, from what everyone said about him, he was the kindest, gentlest man you would ever meet in your life. An amazing story. He, during the Blitz of Britain in 1940, when kids, you know, when families were in the subways as bomb shelters, when London is getting bombed by the German Luftwaffe, he sent, during Christmas, he sent a whole bunch of packages of presents and a whole bunch of envelopes with money for the kids that were in these bomb shelters.
Wow.
Because he's like, this is a terrible Christmas. Let's do something to lighten it up a little bit.
Wow.
Like 5,000 presents, 5,000 envelopes with just small amount of money in them. And he got from the War Commission sent him a thank you note later and saying, you're the only one in your profession that has done something like this, which is really remarkable for an emigre from Germany to do this from when his country, his home country is bombing where his new home is, which is a really remarkable story. So, he was a remarkable person. He was, and along with this iconic role. Moving on to the film set and the design, it looks like a nightmare, basically. It's based on German Expressionism, the painting style, and the sets are weird. I mean, they're jagged, edged, and they're off-kilter. Everything's a little bit weird on this film, and that's very deliberate. Robert Wine, the director, wanted to do this. He wanted to show this kind of scape, which also kind of ties in with the fact that it's kind of a madman's remembering of something that never really happened.
But dreamlike.
Exactly. It wasn't in color, but it was tinted. So at night, there's this dark blue. During the day, it's more yellow. So to help do the mood of the film, they did some tinting on the film. This was before color film, of course. They were able to do that, though. Because of the not only the sets, like I said, it had a huge influence on German film. So after 1920, you see all these silent German films with these kind of weird expressionist sets, some very dreamlike quality, something we've really never seen since. It's a really distinct period in film. Now, it would have an influence on film in general, because of that. Like, most people consider it the first horror film, considering not only the sets, but of course the plot and everything of madness and all this stuff. So it has a lot of influence on horror movies moving forward, but it also influenced film noir with its lighting. If you watch how they lit things with the tall shadows and the lighting in just in jagged areas of the film, you will see where a lot of the lighting came from for film noir back in the United States in the 30s and the 40s. So it had a huge influence on that as well.
There's a quote in front of Seth, necessity is the mother of invention.
Right.
It's up there because of what we do here. We're creatives and we do creative work. Mm-hmm. And I think that some of the greatest creativity comes from necessity. A lot of that was from necessity. There was electricity was rationed post-World War II.
Right.
So a lot of the things where he had to paint like right. You know, lights on his paint on the walls and the backdrops, they couldn't use a lot of electricity. So he had to creatively figure out how to make this work and to kind of lean into it a little bit, which, like you said, like had people just took that and ran with it.
Yep.
And you'll hear a number of people when you Google this movie or look at it and everything, that it is kind of the godfather of horror, the creator of horror and stuff, that genre. That's all very true. But it's also the creator of the twist ending.
Yes.
It's, from everything I could tell, it is the first time in cinema that there is a twist ending. And I think that if you ask most modern people, most people, anybody out there, what was the first twist ending? Oh, something in the 70s, maybe. Something in the 80s, maybe, something like that. Oh,
or that's a Hitchcock movie or something, right?
Yeah, something like that. Man, right at the gate, right out the gate we came out. Aha, twist!
Yes.
How cool of a creativeness that is. Mm-hmm. And what a challenge to the rest of us to picking up the ball afterwards and everything. It's a really cool note on the movie.
I'm glad you said that, because there's two twists in the movie.
Yeah.
The one I said at the beginning or the middle, right smack in the middle of the film, you see that this madman who you've seen manipulate people and send his guy to kill people and everything like that. And, oh, wait, he's the director of an insane asylum. Oh, no, this is not good, right?
I hate when that happens.
And then the twist at the end when you realize, and then it's become a cliche, you know, it was all a dream, right? When you find out, no, this is actually just a madman. And so you see all the characters throughout the movie in the asylum. He has created this world that this is how he's dealing with his madness, kind of thing. So, yeah, I mean, it's our views on mental illness have changed in 100 years, so you have to take that with a grain of salt. Yeah. So it doesn't handle it the best way, but that's kind of how they dealt with people who had mental problems back in the day. They just throw them kind of into an asylum, and that's where we ended up.
Gives us a little perspective on that, which is always nice.
A couple of other things I did want to touch on before wrapping up, a couple of specific scenes. Now, Conrad Veidt was, like I said, you know, he was a tremendous professional actor. There's one scene in particular that just really got me when my son and I were watching it. It's the first scene with him. They opens the coffin and there's Cesar asleep. And Caligari is like, now giving him the speech, you know, the barking, the come on, come all kind of thing. And he says, now I'm going to wake him up. And this is where you can ask him any question. He knows all. And he says, wake up. And they do a close up. I mean, an extreme close up of Veidt's face. Mm-hmm. And as you see him struggle to wake up, he makes muscles in his face twitch. And I don't know how he did that.
Yeah.
It's an amazing scene
where
you totally believe this man has been asleep for 24 years or whatever it was that he said it was. And twitching his eyes, his face, and then his eyes open. It's a marvelous scene. Yeah, it's very, very cool. One of the other ones that I took note of is when Cesar, the sleepwalker, attacks Jane, who's the main woman, the main love interest in the film. When he first pulls out the knife, like he's going to stab her, looks at her, stops, and goes down to abduct her. The struggle of him grabbing her was actually somewhat shocking, I have to say, mostly because the movie to this point is like we've seen. You know, we talked about, you know, it's more the exaggerated movements.
Yeah.
You know, you feel that, you know, as you get into the movie, you know, you get used to these kind of like really the eyes, like you said, you know, like the very furtive looks, like this close-ups and then these broad gestures and stuff. This is a scene that looks real. like it wasn't actually happening. Not that, you know, he was actually hurting her, but the struggle with that is very jarring from the other parts of the movie because it looks very real and it's like, whoa, I wasn't expecting that kind of thing. It's a very big thing. We already touched on the twists already of one of the things that made it very distinctive was these twists that they threw out the film. And I have to say, it is, it does, when you're getting into it, it is moves a little slow at the beginning, but once it gets going, man, it pulls you right in, just like any movie today would do. It really gets you going. So
it is
a classic, and not only because of all the influence that it had on future movies and even up to today, but because it is just a good movie. It's a good, well-made film back from 1920.
It isn't just Seth or others that have highlighted this movie and loved this movie. This movie actually played at one time in Paris, in a Paris theater for 7 years straight.
Oh, my God.
7 years straight they played this movie. Like, I love that movie in Paris.
Does that surprise anyone? No, not right. Really. Not in Paris. But.
You know, sometimes we tend to think that, movies nowadays, it's darker or it's this or that or anything. They've been doing dark movies and macabre movies.
Oh, my gosh.
Since they were able to film each other doing movies. Like, it's a dark story. Like the Gold Rush was a darker story.
There's definitely dark elements in that. Yeah.
It starts with it saying a dramatic comedy. You know, I mean, it's a genre starter. Both of these movies are genre starters. They're the beginnings of these kind of things that we just know so well now. I'm so glad that you brought up the cast with this movie. It's an integral cast and actors that we don't get to talk about very much.
Yep.
If you don't mind to just go back real quick for a second, because I wanted
Let's
to mention Big Jim McKay is played by Max Swain, who does a great job, a lot of facial expressions I was talking about and everything. And as much as I love Charlie in this movie, one of my favorite old school actresses, Georgia Hale, is in this. Georgia would end up being in a couple of other bigger roles in her career. This was the one that really got her started on it. And when I'm talking about acting with your eyes, Chaplin, so many of these actors are great at it. Georgia Hale, just her eyes alone acting, may have been some of the greatest acting you'll ever see, let alone the rest of her. Fantastic actress that is lost in the shuffle when we talk about legendary actors.
Yeah.
She doesn't get brought up, and I'm not saying that she necessarily should be, but I feel like her name should be mentioned when we talk about these old school actors.
Giving them credit where it's due. You know, it seems in a lot of ways, going back to the whole silent movie thing, that it seems so long ago. It seems so far away from what you're used to today with films and all this stuff. But you can, going back, and I think we've done a good job, I hope, of highlighting the stuff that's there. Remember, this is all new when they made it. You know, like James was saying, the twist ending. It's de rigueur now. It's stuff that where's the twist? You know, we know it's coming. Where it is. This was it. This is where it started, everyone. The finding out comedy. Silent comedy is some of the most brilliant comedy out there because you cannot rely on the joke. Yeah. You cannot rely on the funny sound effect. We don't have any of that. That's why there's an edge to it. And I mean by the edge, I mean there's a seriousness to it that you don't see. Yeah. Chaplin did it brilliantly. Buster Keaton was the master at the stone face comedy. You've got Harold Lloyd, kind of the third guy of the big comedian, silent comedians, but putting himself literally in danger, hanging off buildings, to make people laugh.
Yeah.
This is something you do not see anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, this is genuine comedy. I guess I'm biased on this, but because I'm not a big fan of modern comedies that much, but this is the stuff. That all of this is built on, and it's some of the best you will ever see.
Entertaining wise, these movies not only hold up, they're timeless.
Absolutely.
They are classics. Mm-hmm. And thank you so much for bringing up this idea, man. I really have enjoyed doing these episodes. Looking forward to doing more.
I love the fact that we can talk about this stuff. And maybe someone who's not even considered seeing an old silent movie, maybe they'll get the urge to see something.
Be sure to get us your suggestions, too, of movies you'd like us to go over, dissect, and have some fun with and everything. We appreciate your feedback, as always, everyone.
Yes, indeed. And we'll be back soon with more Director's Cut. Of course, we got new shows that we're working on, more guests that we want to bring to you guys, and just keep listening here to Director's Cut on WFHR.